Hello everyone, and thank you for joining today's webinar, Data Science Virtual Machine, a walkthrough of end-to-end analytics scenarios. Our presenter for today is Barnum Bora, Program Manager at Microsoft. Before we begin, I'd like to cover a few housekeeping items. Today's presentation will run for about an hour. The webinar is being recorded and will be available on demand within 48 hours. A copy of today's presentation and a link to the recording will be sent to you via email once the files are available. If you have any questions during the webcast, please enter your question in the Q&A widget to the right of your screen and click Submit. We'll get through as many questions as we can during the live broadcast. With that, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Barnum.
Hello, everyone. This is Barnum, and thank you for joining us today. As you are already aware, this webinar is primarily focused on the Data Science Virtual Machine offerings through the Microsoft Azure Cloud. But before we go dive into the content of the webinar, I thought it'll be best if we, since we do have quite a few registrations, it'll be best to actually see what the level of knowledge or familiarity is with the Data Science Virtual Machine offerings amongst you attendees, and also with regards to where in the data science landscape do you work today and where you are at with data science proficiency in general. So I'm just going to post a couple of questions. We'll probably wait 2 minutes each for your responses. And then based on sort of the responses, I'll try to structure the presentation to address the needs of the audience. So I'm just going to post the questions now. So the first question that I just posted is primarily about your awareness of the data science virtual machine. Please feel free to vote on the poll, and that'll give us an idea of where you are at with your awareness level for the VM. We're just going to wait probably roughly about a minute. Okay, we'll probably just give about 30 seconds actually. All right, last 10 seconds, and then we'll move on to the next question soon. And moving on to the next question now. All right, this question is primarily about your data science experience in general. So feel free to, record your own experience. This is just for us to get an idea of where it's at for the whole audience. So 30 seconds. All right, I'm just going to show the results of the first one. Hopefully you've recorded all of your polls already. Right, so this is the awareness level for the data science VM. Looks like there's quite a few people who have heard of it. Some of you have never heard of it, but again, it's a gentle mix, know it at a high level. So I guess that gives us an idea that we'll probably start and tell you a little bit more about the actual offering itself rather than go straight into demos and stuff like that. And let's look at the results for the data science experience in general. Right. So again, we do have quite a few of you who are in the data analyst BI professional space, roughly 30%. And again, it's a it looks like a pretty even split across all the others. So again, we'll keep it light, but we'll also keep it content heavy as well. So let's go from there. So today's agenda, very quickly before we go into it, is so like I said, we'll give you a brief introduction into the data science virtual machine, and looks like because of the poll itself, I'll give you a little bit more of an introduction, and then we'll walk through quite a few scenarios using SQL Server, our services, using a local Spark instance on the DSVM, deep learning. And then we'll also go into some sort of a little bit of a demo into querying with different tools across different source systems, both in the cloud and also on your own machines or in on-premise systems. And we'll discuss a bit of the roadmap of the data science virtual machine. And then, if time permitting, we will go into some of the questions that you're asking if we deem that they're or worth sharing with everyone or not too specific. All right. So first things first. I do want to point out that this is more of a webinar about the data science virtual machine offering itself, and we plan to walk you through that as opposed to being a tutorial for data science itself. So this is not going to train you how to be a data scientist. This is more about the tooling and what we provide through the data science VM offering. So first things first, what is the data science virtual machine? It is actually very self-explanatory, simple title. So the data science virtual machine is a set of images, which virtual machine images, which are available for you to use through the Azure cloud, the Microsoft cloud platform, which is what we call Azure. And what are these virtual machine images? They're basically available in the Windows and the Linux flavor, Windows being at the moment Windows Server 2012, and the Linux one being CentOS 7. And we'll discuss the roadmap around it later. But the idea is for us to provide a curated set of images where we actually do the research behind what tooling needs to go on those images based on our conversations and research and data collection from data scientists across the globe, both within Microsoft and outside of Microsoft. And then we provide the curated images in a way that any data scientist or analyst who wants to work with work on data science problems or analytical problems, they have all of these tools available at their disposal through a very easy to use desktop in the cloud sort of framework, rather than having to maintain all of the packages, maintain all of the versions, et cetera, and install all the tools and compile all the libraries, et cetera, by yourself. We do that for you, and we try to maintain a cadence which sort of matches the major releases that come around with languages with the likes of Python and R and stuff like that. So very, very high level. We cater to all of the languages which are popular within the data science community, namely R, Python, Julia. Obviously, we do have C# and Java as well, based on which version you're using. We also put in a lot of the popular development tools, including Visual Studio, Community Edition, Visual Studio Code, Jupyter Notebooks. We obviously have Git installed. And then we also package in the ML and AI frameworks that are popular. So Microsoft's own Cognitive Toolkit, also known as CNTK, Vopal Wabbit, XGBoost, MXNet. There's quite a few of those tools that are already packaged in and pre-configured on the VM. If you've ever worked with these tools, you will realize that actually getting started with a lot of these tools is the hard part because of the nature of how the installations go, how the libraries go, and stuff like that. So we attempt to simplify all of that for an individual scenario and also for an enterprise scenario. Again, we also have a lot of the popular data exploration and visualization tools, namely Power BI or SQL Server. Already, we do have a SQL Server Developer Edition already installed on the Windows VM, for example. And then we have our usual data ingestion tools. and platform tools which enable you to work with the assets that are available in the Azure landscape and the Microsoft landscape and also the open source landscape as well. So all of your SDKs that are required to be installed into your Visual Studio, for example, in the right versions and connected to your Azure accounts, et cetera, are already provided on the VM. So we take all of that, we do it on a sort of almost monthly cadence, and we try to curate it and test it and then provide you the best possible image that a data scientist can start off with. Obviously, if you do have the need for other tools, we do have ways for you to request that and stuff like that. So moving on, hopefully that gives you a bit of a good idea about what the Data Science VM actually is. The development flow for using a data science VM tends to be you have your primary data sources. It could be some storage in the cloud. It could be some Hadoop store in the cloud or on-premise. It doesn't necessarily matter. Some relational, non-relational data. You have the data science VM as your primary dev and test and data science development environment primarily, and you either use this environment to move the data in if you're doing a lot of in-memory stuff, or in cases where you can predicate the analytics to the source systems, then great, like in the case of SQL Server or Microsoft R, you basically use the data science VM as the front end, but then the back end processing actually happens on server side. And then finally you have the trained models which can be deployed into your reporting framework or your scoring framework or operationalized framework into multiple different destination systems. It could be Spark, could be Azure Machine Learning, could be SQL Server with R, could be Microsoft R Server, you name it. So there's a bunch of different places where your trained models can go. So that's effectively the usual, development sort of flow with the data science VM. So now, just as a quick reference, I'm not going to walk you through all of the things in this slide. This is effectively just a quick reference for you to see what the similarities and differences are between the Windows Server and the Linux edition. Obviously, there's going to be a few changes, but this is just a quick reference guide, and hopefully when you get the slide deck later on demand, you'll have something to refer to. So in case of today's presentation, we are going to be using, most of today's examples are worked out as Jupyter notebooks. For those of you who know what they are, and these are basically a popular way for us to, in the data science and development community, to share code, equations, visualizations, documentation and stored output, etc. Again, the focus of this session is predominantly towards demonstrating the scenarios as opposed to discussing the data science algorithms and the methods used in the examples. The goal is not to get the best data science out of this particular session, and the goal is definitely not to iteratively improve and get the best accuracy or best AUC curve or anything like that. It's more so about actually getting to a point where we understand the different scenarios of usage. So hopefully that's clear. So before we go into the first few examples, I think let's do a bit of a data set a refresher. So one of the most common data sets you'll see in today's example is that of the New York Taxis data set. For those of you, I'm guessing if you're in the data community, you've probably seen this data set being used quite a few times. We're basically using a sample of the New York Taxis data set. It consists of two sets of files with trip data and fare data and stuff like that. I don't want to go into too much details of this data set, but effectively, this is the one of the data sets that we're using. Let me actually now go into one of the scenarios. So I'm going to take a moment and start sharing a screen, if that's okay with you. Just give me a moment, please. So the first scenario we're going to talk about today is SQL Server R Services. And I'm going to start my screen share. So as I said before, this is we are going to use Jupyter Notebooks. This is one of the notebooks that is already available on the Data Science VM. This is basically a Jupyter Notebook that walks you through an end-to-end scenario of using the New York Taxis data set for predictions and stuff like that. In the interest of time, I'm not going to not going to show you exactly how and every piece of code is running, but we're just going to go through just the pieces of code that really matter. If you are wondering what this is actually I've actually just logged into the Data Science Virtual Machine, the Windows version. This is the Windows version of the Data Science Virtual Machine that I've logged into. As you can see, a bunch of the tools are already installed and whatnot. We have all of the tools and algorithms that I spoke to you before that are already installed. Also, if you're wondering how I got to this point where, for those of you who are not familiar with Microsoft Azure or VMs in Microsoft Azure, so here's something that I wanted to show you. This is the Microsoft Azure portal. I'm just waiting for it to render for you guys. So this is the Microsoft Azure portal. So if you go to portal.azure.com, this is a place where you can start, deploying your own services or your own resources. So in the case of Data Science VM, you would just go into here and look for Data Science. And it will give you a list of the Data Science options. In our case, you could choose the Data Science Virtual Machine or the Linux Virtual Machine. I'm just going to choose this. It gives you a bit of the terms, and then you go and click Create. In the interest of time, I've actually just put in the data into one over here. So you basically put in your name as your username, password, whatever, your usual data. Click OK, and this is where kind of gets interesting. This is where you choose what type of VM or what SKU of VM you're looking for. This is kind of where you will go in and choose, hey, do I want a small size machine, like with one core, 3.5 gigs of RAM, that's basically like a shared proc sort of machine, versus you can go for a very, very massive machine, like 20 cores, 140 gigs of RAM, or like even bigger. So basically, you're choosing what sort of machine you want. We do have, again, different SKUs that will enable you to do different things. And one of the good things to note at this point is that you can start off with a small machine and then reconfigure to a different machine if you want. So depending on your usage, let's say you need to train a model for a little while, so you need a bunch of memory, so you can go for a 56 gig memory machine for 4 hours. So, and then you can scale back down. That's the beauty of the cloud, effectively. So just going to go away from that. So let's go back to the Data Science VM over here. So this is our Data Science VM so that I had just opened before. So in this case, first let me quickly show you, so if you're familiar, so we have SQL Server Management Studio here. The Data Science VM, the Windows version, actually already ships with SQL Server 2016 Developer Edition. So as you can see, we've actually got the New York Taxis database on SQL Server already installed. Once You actually go into Management Studio. You can actually go and have a look at what tables are, what the stored procedures are, etc., etc. This is effectively what the New York Taxis dataset kind of looks like over here. Now we're going to use it in other examples through today as well. So let me now go back into the actual SQL Server walkthrough. Right. So what this is a let me just walk you through what's actually happening here. So imagine you're a data scientist. You have your data set in a server, and in this case, in for this example, a SQL Server with our services on there. One of the things that you would want to do is obviously start playing with the data, start creating features, and you want to develop your models, and you want to test them, you want to score, and then deploy them, and score with them later on, and you keep on doing that loop. So effectively, in this particular scenario, this is just a script that is actually running the scenario. So let's just go through the script very, very quickly. So in this particular script, at first, obviously, you're just installing the R packages that are required for this particular example. So nothing too crazy going on there. We're adding a few library paths over here because the local service does not have write permissions. So this is just something that you need to be aware of when you're doing this. And by the way, all of these notebooks are available on the VM. So if you do provision the VM, this is something that you can use as a framework to build your own models. You're looking at what the username is. So if you notice back in Management Studio, notebooks is the prefix that we're using. So that's your username prefix, and it's functioning under for all tables or anything that gets deployed over here. And then, so it's basically just telling you that, hey, that's the prefix that we're using as a base name. Then we're specifying the R connection over here. If you've ever worked with SQL Server, you'll be familiar with connection strings for SQL Server. This is where you're defining the connection string and setting the compute context. Effectively, I'm not going to go into the details of the three functions that you need to be aware of, Rx functions or Revo scale functions. The links are provided. You can go into the details of that. Effectively, it's basically creating a connection to the SQL Server instance. In this case, the SQL Server is installed for test and dev purposes on the VM itself. For in your case, it might be a SQL 2016 instance somewhere else. Once you're done that, once you have your connection set up, then you actually go into defining the data source, basically a select query against that particular database. So in this case, for example, this is the select query that we are using. It's the same query that I had pasted into your SQL Server Management Studio just to show you, and that's kind of what the data set looks like. So you've already obviously got what your tip amount is, fare amount, your usual New York taxi stuff. Not going to labor on about that. And then you're just doing a few, just your usual our housekeeping stuff, and you're defining, hey, these are numeric data types, especially for the longitudes and the latitudes. And then let's say you want to understand the data at this point. There's multiple ways you can try and understand the data. I personally, because I come from a background where I work with visualizations, I used to work with visualizations quite a lot, so I prefer to work and try and understand the data visually. So you can choose to do it my way, or you can choose to do it a more traditional data scientist kind of way, and you can choose to do both. So this is kind of where we're getting into using the Rx getInfo function, which actually basically just gives you the numerical summaries of the data for each of the variables, and then you just start getting into what's actually going on in that data. What's the as you can see. In my case, I actually try to understand it visually, like I said, so I do use Power BI quite a bit. So this is kind of what my visual understanding will probably look like of the same data, All right, so you know, this is we'll get into this a little bit later, but I just wanted to show you, like, this is me playing with the data on Power BI. So once you have an understanding of the data, now you want to, like, visualize it within Jupyter Notebook itself. So what we're doing here is a very popular way to look at look for relationships in data, etc. Cube plots or level plots. So basically, you here we are just defining what the cube actually looks like. That's kind of what it looks like, and then we're doing a level plot for the tip amount, just to. And this is trip distance versus passenger count. And then create a couple of more cube plots just to give us a bit more understanding of longitude versus latitudes and for drop-off and for pickup. And then finally, we do a few histograms. If you notice, anything that says Rx like that, so when we're using Rx, we're basically using scale functions available through the Microsoft R, as opposed to your typical CRAN R, CRAN or open source R packages. Rx, what it does is basically it allows you to deal with data which is bigger than your memory or RAM, and this is basically the scale R functions that you can go and have a look at that are provided through Microsoft R or R services in this case. Now, we look at the histogram for the different modes of payment. Fare, and this is the fare amount versus the counts of how many of those trips actually happen with that kind of fare. And then finally, this is where it gets interesting. This is where we're using the Rx exec to execute on the SQL Server. On the SQL Server side, we execute our code to actually start plotting some of this stuff on a map. So we're using ggmap and mapproj to actually use the geocode and then plot it. And this is kind of what it looks like in the end. So when, like I said, again, I'm not going to go through the details of the code today. That's not the premise of today's discussion. I just wanted to show you how this was possible. So basically all of the scoring happens, and then you finally have the plots over here. Actual plotting is happening over here, and then you have the map over here. So in the case of any kind of data science, you're doing your feature engineering, and in this case you define a function compute dist, which is a CRAN function. It's a CRAN R function that you're doing, not a scaled R function, which is basically computing the distance between different sets of longitudes and latitudes just to look at the trip distance. This is just a feature that you create. And then what you do is once you've got the data into a data frame, which is basically through a select statement, and then you basically pass, calculate the distances for the trips. You basically treat that as a feature, and then you add that back to the back as a back to the source data as a feature. So this is basically what's happening. So you're using these particular scale functions over here to again put it back into the out file, which is the feature data source, and then write back all of the columns that matter. And then finally, and this is feature engineering using a SQL query, it's kind of doing different steps of that whole thing. Again, feel free to walk through this particular example at your own time. In the interest of time, I'm just glossing over quite a few things. And then finally, this is where you're actually training a regression model for building a classifier, basically, to look at, did the person get tipped or not? You're using this particular command frame to actually train the model, and then Yeah, you're using, and then you're just basically testing it out and you making predictions and scoring the output. All right. So once you're actually scored, you obviously need to go into the evaluation. You're actually using the we're using an ROC curve to actually look at how we're performing. Like I said before, this is not the best ROC curve. This is just for demonstration. And then finally, so this is your basic data science workflow until now. I don't want to go labor on about it. What I really care about at this point is model operationalization. So once you've trained your model, this is where you're actually serializing the model, and then you're actually persisting the model inside of SQL Server. So this is the part which actually makes this super interesting. So once you've actually trained the model, you put the model inside SQL Server and make it accessible for consumption. So here in this case, again, feel free to use this code framework with your own trained models. What we've actually done is inside SQL Server, if you go into Management Studio, we've actually created two stored procedures: predictive batch mode and predictive single mode. So what do these stored procedures do? And these are definitions, by the way. What do these stored procedures do? They actually provide an easy way to consume either a single prediction or a batch prediction. And that's what we're doing over here: single prediction scores over here versus a batch prediction over here. So that makes your model available for execution and scoring through multiple different ways from different applications or anything like that. So kind of just to recap, we actually went through doing scaled data science within SQL Server and using the RX functions from Microsoft R services within SQL Server to actually train models on big data sets. And once we have the trained models, we actually persist those models inside SQL Server as stored procedures. And once those stored procedures are available, then you can score by executing those particular score stored procedures. Please refer to the documentation link that we've actually got here, and the R services documentation, to actually look at how you can define those stored procedures. It's fairly standard. All right, I am going to go back to my slides for a little bit. So we just spoke to you about this particular scenario. So the next scenario that I wanted to actually talk to you about was the scenario of using a local Spark instance on the data science VM. All right. So the local Spark instance on the data science VM is available on the Linux data science VM. And let me actually quickly take you to that. I'm just going to start my screen share. So the Linux Data Science Virtual Machine is available in a CentOS flavor, and it's kind of wherever possible, made both the Windows and the Linux one comparable to each other. And in this case, the Linux Data Science Virtual Machine is this is our Linux Data Science Virtual Machine. I've logged in through X2Go, which is an XFCE client. And let me actually show you what is actually happening here. And in this particular data science virtual machine, for the Linux flavor, we actually have a local Spark instance. So why is that important? Because of this. Let me quickly show you why. So because Spark clusters are generally expensive, so it becomes a barrier for test and development, and you don't necessarily want to use massive clusters just for test and dev. So we had a lot of requests from people to say, hey, how do we make a test and development on Spark on very small samples of data, very easy. So out of born out of those requests was the local Spark instance on the VM. So basically what we're doing, we actually have a Spark local process, which is handling your head and worker roles on the Hadoop region inside the Linux Data Science VM. And based on, you know, because we've already configured the Yarn Resource Manager in a way where you can point your code to that local Spark instance and then execute that. And if you're developing in Yarn mode, the ability that it allows you to actually go and have a look and change your Hadoop region and your Yarn config. And actually run it against the production cluster once you've actually built the code is why, but allows you to easily deploy and scale your code from your local Spark instance to a distributed Spark cluster that you're running in production. This provides you sort of that flexibility of development. Let us now go through the data set again. This is, we're still using the New York Taxis data set. Because we did cover a bit of Microsoft R Server, I just wanted to give some love to Spark R, so which is also another distributed R framework available on Spark. Mind you, you can definitely choose to use Microsoft R Server on Spark, and we are very proud of what we've developed in Microsoft R Server or R on Spark through Microsoft R. This is just for the sake of an example. We're just using a Spark R example. In this particular example, let me quickly go back to my screen share. So in this particular example, this is the example I want to talk to you about. This example, again, was actually a tutorial which was done by our people from our org at the Strata conference in San Jose recently, and I want to thank them, and especially Dave Rutsch, who's from our org, who actually helped me out quite a bit to try and make this available for you guys. The code is also available on GitHub as well, and we'll send out the links through the emails after this session. So in this case, what we're doing is we actually have the data is already inside the VM, and we are actually the data is already loaded. In this particular case, this is our markdown file, which I'm just going to walk you through. So we're actually the parts which actually matter over here is when you are where is your Yarn config directory. Where is your Hadoop home set to? So in this case, it's set to your local machine or your local Spark instance. So based on changing these and changing a few things in the actual configuration file, which is this is where your Yarn configuration actually changes. All this stuff is on GitHub, by the way. So feel free to go and change that. This is our config file. So all of the stuff that is highlighted over here, actually you can delete it because you don't need it if you're doing it on a HD Insight cluster as opposed to your local Spark cluster. And then we'll make all of this available, by the way. Obviously go and change your actual Spark home over here in your script itself. So you set the environment initially. You load the libraries that you need, and then you create the Spark context based on that. You only do this once, once you've set the Spark context, this is where you're reading from a set of HDFS files or Parquet, CSV or Parquet. In this case, Parquet files tend to perform better, so. But we still use CSVs over here just for this example. And this is the same data set that we used before. It's just reading the data set, so nothing too exciting over here. You're just reading this into a kind of a data frame. This is just showing you the schema of the data, what's actually happening. But once you've actually looked at the data, you have a good understanding of it. This is basically just showing the schema. Now you get into data wrangling and cleanup. And by the way, this tutorial was a multi-hour tutorial, so I am not doing it justice at all. Please feel free to go through the GitHub code and the tutorial through Strata. So my point is that I just want to show you what actually the flow of it is. So you're basically wrangling through Spark SQL over here. This is a select statement, as you can see, very similar to the one we showed you initially in Management Studio. And then you're creating a data frame over here, or a temporary view. And then you're using a SQL again to actually create the futures. And which is, again, similar to what we were doing in the previous example, creating, in this case, you're changing a few numerical features, like our time features, to categorical. Instead, last time around, one of the features that we were doing was the trip distance. You do that, and then we actually go and plot the data. In this particular example, that's the last time. Then once you have the data the full New York Taxis data set is massive. So the point here is we are using a very, very small sample of that data. As you can see, the fraction is very, very small from the actual initial data set. Because we're doing this test and dev on our local Spark instance. Once you've actually done your development and once you're ready that you know that this code works, then you change the Spark context, then you change your Hadoop region, and you go and actually run it across your tons of data that you have sitting in a production Hadoop cluster or production Spark cluster. So that's kind of the idea. So you don't want to hog that production cluster just for your test and dev. You do the test and dev on your local Spark instance. And then once you're ready that and your code is actually working, for smaller stuff, if you're familiar with Spark and you want to do it right away here, great. For the larger stuff, you want to do the test and dev, and then you deploy to the final production cluster. Just doing a little bit of summarization for SQL. This is a little bit advanced. It's basically looking at a few groups and how they're behaving, cash versus card, etc. And then finally, you're basically using some sample data for the modeling. And again, I am glossing over a lot of this code. Please feel free to go through the code in detail and the tutorial in detail later on. You're partitioning into train and test, your usual data science workflow, and then creating a GLM model using Spark R. And then once you have evaluated your model, this is kind of where your labels versus prediction, you're just doing an evaluation of that. Kind of looks okay. And then once you've done that, you save your model, your GLM model. So that this model can be deployed to, either containerized and deployed or deployed to a different cluster or whatever. So this is another example of how you can do Spark development using your local Spark instance, and you don't necessarily have to have an expensive Spark cluster to do Spark development using the Data Science VM. So that's another example we wanted to show very quickly. So now, in the interest of time, let me quickly move to, hopefully that is clear. So let me quickly move to the next section. This gets exciting. I don't have a lot of time, so please bear with my going through things very quickly. This next scenario, we do have something called, which actually tackles deep learning through the data science VM. So effectively, the data science, in this particular scenario, I'm going to walk through an example where we deal with the MNIST dataset. If you're not familiar with the MNIST dataset is basically a collection of roughly 60,000 images of handwritten digits which we then score using a deep neural network to score what the actual digits are. So it's kind of like an OCR. example, feel free to use the link to actually go and learn about the MNIST dataset or download it and use it yourself. How do we do this? The Data Science VM actually has a third flavor other than just the Windows and Linux VMs. This is the Deep Learning Toolkit for Data Science VM. The Deep Learning Toolkit effectively is based on the actual Windows image, Windows Server image, and we put a few extra things which actually, you know, are your GPU drivers, etc. Basically, what it means is that it actually deploys directly on the NC class of Azure VM. So remember when I was showing you the Azure portal and choosing which particular VM SKU to use, this deploys on the NC class SKUs only. So they are available across a few data center regions of Microsoft today, and more so becoming available across more and more regions. The idea is that they're available in a 1, 2, or 4 K80 GPU classification. So this is sort of the classification for how what level of GPU compute capacity do you need. A physical card that you can buy roughly has 2 K80 GPUs, but you can go, like, not necessarily, not everyone needs that kind of amount, so we decided to have a 1 K80 GPU option as well. It's just like a half a physical card, and then goes up to 4. So deep learning, why is it important? Because GPU-based parallelization, it provides orders of magnitude improvement in performance when it comes to deep learning versus doing it on CPUs. And which is why this is a shout out to NVIDIA for this particular graphic. As you can see, they're generally a lot faster for these kind of workloads. In today's example, this is sort of what we're looking at. We have a deep learning model with two hidden layers. I am assuming, for the sake of this audience, that you are familiar with what deep learning is. You have this sort of in the input, as you can see on the left, which is effectively your handwritten objects, and then you get an output layer, which is giving you the scored digits that you're getting from that. All right? So let me go back to my screen share. And for this example, I'm using the Windows Virtual Machine again. This is the Windows Virtual Machine. My Windows Virtual Machine, when I set it up, was initially a deep learning toolkit machine anyway. So you can do this, some of these examples, not this particular one, but you can do deep learning on CPUs as well. So you can use some of the code across CPUs, but for the sake of this, we are actually using the GPUs for this particular example, right? So let me quickly go to this. So in the interest of time, this is the data loader notebook, which I'm not going to go through, because this is kind of sort of tells you what the images actually look like. The data, just assume for this case, the data has actually been loaded. We will, if you go fire up your own Data Science VM, you will have access to this code anyway. So this is the code that I wanted to quickly go through. What's actually happening here? So as I said, this is what the data actually looks like. In this particular example, we're using CNTK. CNTK is a Microsoft distributed network framework for deep learning. So CNTK, or Microsoft Cognitive Toolkit, think of it as an alternative to like TensorFlow by Google or something like that. So it's a very performant set of algorithms that we develop, and I'm just using CNTK for this example. And you can use MXNet or TensorFlow or CNTK, or it doesn't really matter. So we, again, just to go through what the code is actually doing, you're importing your components that you really need. As you can see in this case, I've actually set the default device to GPU. If you go through the relevant CNTK documentation, you'll see that you can set the default device as GPU or CPU. It doesn't really matter. One thing to note, though, if you are running this on a laptop with a GPU, sometimes what you might see is that your laptop's just to preserve energy. You know, if these kind of things, you might, if you're running CNTK on a laptop, you might see that it's still running on CPU because they might just, you know, turn off their GPU just to preserve energy. And to avoid those kind of things, the DSVM has its dedicated GPU capacity, and we're using the Tesla class of GPUs, which are designed for compute-heavy workloads, not for graphics. So in this particular case, we've actually got the data, as I said, is basically a bunch of images. What we're doing here is actually the you know, for this particular case, we're actually saying, hey, the dimensions are 784, which is 28 times 28 pixels for the data, and then the output classes is 10. Why is it 10? It's effectively just the number of outputs that it could have, so which is the 10 digits from 0 to 9. You have the, this is where we're defining the input labels, and then, you know, as you can see, 60,000 training images and 10,000 test images. Again, I'm not going to go through all of the code here. This is just standard, you know, your usual standard Python code, so you should be able to read through it at a later time. And then this is where the model creation is actually happening. So two hidden layers in this particular model, the input layer, two hidden layers, and then output layer. We have the dimensions of the hidden layers, 400 nodes. And then this is a key concept to understand when you're using CNTK. Your input variable is basically a container in which we put the different observations. So it basically needs to match your input image for this particular example. And then you basically have your output variable. Output is effectively what the nodes do to that particular image, and then go from there, are the weights. This is a feed-forward network, so there are no loops in this particular network. We have some documentation of how feed-forward networks actually work, so feel free to go through this. There is also another example, a simpler example. Again, in the interest of time, let me actually quickly gloss through what's actually happening. We define the layers, your fully connected feed-forward network. There are no loops or no backpropagation happening in this particular network. You define your linear layer, dense layer, and then your finally your classifier. And then, you know, you use your either a sigmoid function or a ReLU function as your activation function. And then you create the fully connected classifier over here, and then we're using your softmax as one of the model parameters, and then finally this is where the training is happening. So in this particular, if you don't want to go through this, or let me just quickly go through the actual running the trainer section. This is where you're configuring the trainer, the learning rate as 0.2. What is the learning rate? The learning rate is basically the amount of change you can do to a particular weight at any given layer jump, right? You cannot change a weight more than that. And then finally, this is where you're creating a few helper functions to actually, visualize, different functions later on. And then finally, this is where you're running the trainer. Mini batches, I don't want to go into the details of that, but if you are using mini batches, you'll be able to run them on GPUs. And this is where we're actually training the learner itself. And then finally, we're plotting the data just to look at what's actually happening. This is the training data set, 28 by 28 pixel images. And then finally, this is where we're testing the data, average error of 1.76%, so not bad. And then this is sort of this is where we're actually just doing label versus prediction, what's actually happening. And then this is an easy way to visualize some of the results. So sample number 22, this is basically an image of 6. Somebody had written this, and it's getting scored as 6. Let's try something else. Sample number 2, and that was an image of 0, and it's being scored as 0. So that's just an example of what's actually happening over there. So once you've actually trained these models, you can deploy the model to your own GPU cluster, or trained models can be run on CPU. This is another example of deep learning being made easily available to you on the single box. You don't necessarily have to worry about a major GPU cluster or anything like that. You can choose to, you know, use the deep learning toolkit for a small amount of time or a large amount of time if you have long-running workloads. This is a very small example, but even in this example, I wish I had more time to show you, but if you were to run a similar example on a CPU, it would take you 20x or 30x the time. So imagine if you're doing it across a very, very large data set, it becomes quite unwieldy on the CPU very quickly. So having the ability to do GPU parallelization makes it extremely easy for you to actually go and build your own deep learning models. So the next one, very quickly, just wanted to show you, is actually I quickly wanted to walk you through a new tool that we started putting on the DSVM. Before I show you that, let me actually go back to the data set that I was using before. In this case, what I wanted to show you was Apache Drill. The Apache Drill is basically a cross-platform query engine. But before I show you that, I just wanted to show you the data again. So this is the data sort of for the New York Taxi data set. So one of the tools that are already installed on the Data Science VM is the Power BI tool. And in this case, what I've actually done is if I go into Edit Queries, I'm actually querying that data set. This is my query. If I look at the source and I go Edit Source, it actually show me the SQL statement that I'm connecting to the New York Taxi database with. And then I'm doing a bunch of filters, et cetera, et cetera. So that's effectively what I'm doing. This helps me visualize it. Sometimes you don't necessarily know what the data is. You just want to see what it is. And your data may be cross-platform. Power BI will allow you to do that. Another popular tool from the Apache Foundation that we actually include on the Data Science VM is Apache Drill. So Apache Drill, again, it's not as pretty as Power BI because it is a very focused sort of querying tool. What you basically do is you basically define what your sources are. DFS, this is your local file system. This is a file system that I've this is a store that I've actually specified. This is basically pointing to a Microsoft Azure storage blob, which is like this. This is Azure Storage Explorer. This is basically the blob that I'm pointing it to, public share. And then you can query any of these blobs using your, for example, I'm just doing a SQL query from that particular blob, .tripfair.csv, first 10 rows. I do a submit, and it kind of gives me a result that looks like that. So, one of the reasons why we included it is because Apache Drill allows you to do joins across your local file system and Azure blobs and data warehouse, data lake, and bunch of different multiple disparate data sources, kind of similar to Power BI, but it is also something which can be completely schemaless, and you can still read flat files, no problem. So just thought we'd give you a quick primer into that. So let me, that's kind of the end of the demos today. Let me actually quickly go back to the slides and actually go from there. So just to give you a little bit of a roadmap. Before I go into the roadmap, let me show you a summary of what we covered. So today we covered the SQL Server, R services, dev, train, test, deploy, score, using the local Spark instance for a quick dev and test for data science workloads on the Data Science VM, training and deploying deep learning models using the deep learning toolkit for the Data Science VM on GPU-based Azure VMs, and then briefly querying and wrangling across platforms using your Apache Drill. There's many tutorials for these, very, very dedicated tutorials for these that are already available, that we will make available, and we'll give you, share the links for you. But the goal of today was to actually familiarize you that these patterns actually exist and are enabled on the Data Science VM. So we didn't want to teach you how to do data science, we just wanted to show you what we provide. Very quickly on the roadmap, let me actually show you the roadmap. So we do have in the works a Windows Server 2016 based Data Science VM offering. The current VM offering is on 2012. What does that provide us? Containerized workloads, because Windows Server 2016 actually has containers, the container service built in. It also has a Windows 10 style desktop experience. So the current 2008 kind of mimics the old Windows 8 experience, the current 2012 server. Pleased to announce that we've one of our most popular feature requests or product requests is to have Excel. Our 2016 or Office 365 Excel pre-installed on the VM. So we are bringing out. We're currently working to bring out Excel as a pre-installed add-in, pre-installed addition to the Data Science VM on Windows. You will need a Pro Plus subscription to actually sign in and use the Excel. But that's an exciting thing for us because that has been a feature request for a long, long time. We're also bringing out an Ubuntu-based deep learning DSVM, and you'll hear more about it shortly through our blogs. That's something that we're testing right now. And we are investing into other categories like extensions and additions into the IoT landscape, what sort of extensions we can put in, and sort of into cognitive computing as well. So those are sort of the roadmap items. Unfortunately, I can't give you too many details, but do watch this space in the coming days, weeks, months, and hopefully you find DSVM a valuable tool for you. And like I said, quick summary of what we did today. And then finally, I just quickly wanted to share some useful links. And these will be made available to you for viewing and your usage later on as well. So we have the Data Science VM forum. So send through your questions, your feedback, your feature requests, et cetera, through aka.ms/DSVM forum. We have our product page at aka.ms/DSVM. We have a workshop. Goes through setting up your first data science VM, creating your first model, and it's a fully DIY, every step click through workshop that you can use, that's DSVM/workshop on aka.ms. Two-page handout if you want to tell people about DSVM very, very quickly or share around very quickly. We have a two-page handout. And then if you want to actually learn a lot more about the data science in Microsoft itself, and actually get certified and stuff like that, or get your org certified, or do some instructor-led training, go through to learnanalytics.microsoft.com, and that should you will find a bunch of courses and details about instructor-led courses and self-paced courses on there as well. And there's always Microsoft Virtual Academy that'll serve you good as well on that. So that's it for me. Thank you very much for giving us your time and attention, and hopefully we have some questions which are high priority. I'm not sure if we have time for that, or I want to hand over back to Rahi for this.
Thanks, Barnum, for the great presentation. Yeah, so we've gone through most of the questions on the question widgets, so I think we should be good. Just as a reminder to everyone, we'll be sending out the slides and a recording of the session over email in the next 2 days. Please take a moment to fill out the survey questions on your screen. Your feedback really helps us to improve our webinars. Thank you, everyone, for joining, and have a great day.